Hi, I'm Marco Werman. Each weekday, our team focuses on one goal, bringing the world to you. Through our human-centered reporting, we bring you critical international stories that you don't hear anywhere else. In the span of one broadcast, we take you all over the globe, from Ukraine to the United Kingdom, or from Chile to China, in pursuit of the day's news. This is skilled work. It's resource-intensive, and it is expensive to produce. So we're asking for your help. From now through December 31st, the world is participating in Newsmatch. It is a fundraising movement that supports nonprofit newsrooms like ours. We're trying to raise $100,000 from 1,000 listeners between now and the end of the year, and I hope that you, yeah, you, will be one of them. If you donate $100, you'll get a special thank you on our podcast in early 2023, and everyone who donates will be our guests at a virtual party in January. So if you value our journalism, please head to theworld.org/give or visit the link in our episode notes. Thank you, and now the show. Today on the show, more and more people are heading north from the U.S. into Canada without papers. They are crossing the border on foot.
I will explain to you in English. If you cross here, you will be arrested. It's illegal to cross here. You understand that?
And in the United Kingdom, a senior cabinet official is facing heat for the way she's handling immigration policy.
The British people deserve to know which party is serious about stopping the invasion.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, strict lockdowns in China have energized a new trend in tourism, glamping.
People don't want to spend too much time on COVID testing and transportation. They just want to enjoy the short but happy time.
We're talking air-conditioned tents and a morning cappuccino. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for joining us. We begin our show today in the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv, where yesterday's Russian cruise missile and drone strikes left much of the 3 million residents without power or water. Today, a lot of homes had their electricity and running water restored. People in the capital are getting used to a new normal that began more than 8 months ago. From Kyiv, The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
5 a.m. February 24th. That's the date and time that 37-year-old Diana won't forget. It's when war came to her city, Kyiv.
I was in bed and we heard bombs. It's awful. We was for 1 week in underground.
They hid in the basement of their home. Diana, her husband, and their 4-year-old twin daughters, Slava and Arina. In the next days and weeks, as the war intensified, the family moved from one city to another. First, they left Kyiv for the western part of the country, and then they went to Poland. A few months later, they're coming back to Kyiv. When I meet them, they're standing in a long line of mostly women and children at the border. Diana didn't want to share her last name out of safety concerns. This is what war has done to many Ukrainians. Constant displacement. Diana and her kids are going back despite recent attacks. She tells me she worries about how they'll get by in the winter, but she's made up her mind.
Because it's my country and I love my country and I love my husband. I miss about him so much and I will return to him.
Diana and her daughters head towards the waiting train, the twins dragging their penguin suitcases behind them. Meanwhile, in Kyiv, a day after the attacks, the city is back to life. Even the street musicians seem undeterred. Ukrainian officials said yesterday's rocket strikes left roughly 80% of the city without water. Electricity is sporadic too. That's part of Russia's war tactic, says member of Ukraine's parliament, Andriy Osachuk.
As soon as Russians will have problems with the Ukrainian military on the front line, they will start targeting civilians. It's difficult to find a missile for each Ukrainian. So that's why they select tactical, classical Russian tactics of mass destruction. Because switching off electricity for the city of Kyiv, you simultaneously target 2.5 million people.
Like so many in Ukraine, Osachuk is worried about the winter months ahead. He says even though winters have been somewhat warmer in recent years, the lack of heat or electricity will create a lot of problems for people, especially the elderly and the sick. But on the outskirts of the capital, crews are already busy repairing the damage. 47-year-old Yuri Harasko manages a team of workers here. Today's mission is to replace the broken backup electrical system. Harasko says some of his colleagues have had to leave to fight on the front lines, so they're short-staffed. It doesn't help that the Russian military keeps targeting the grids, plunging whole cities into darkness. Harasko says never in his 20 years of work has he been under so much pressure. Still, he says his work is part of the resistance to Russia's aggression. We're not heroes, he tells me. The heroes are the ones fighting on the front lines. He says he, too, has experienced power outages at home. His family has stocked up on candles and camping stoves. We're just like everybody else, he says, with a smile. And with that, the crew is back to work, shoveling, chanting, and even...
Yesterday... All my troubles seem so far away. Now it look and hear stain. Oh, I believe in yesterday.
For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari, Kyiv, Ukraine.
Suddenly. Enough. Enough for today.
The war in Ukraine brought a swift halt to shipments of grain out of the country's ports along the Black Sea. And because Ukraine is such an important global supplier of corn and wheat, prices spiked worldwide. Then in July, the UN brokered a deal between Ukraine, Russia, and Turkey to open up sea routes through Istanbul and get the grain moving to countries in need around the world. Over the weekend, Russia halted its participation in the so-called Black Sea Grain Initiative. It said Ukraine had used the shipping lane to attack Russian warships based in Crimea, a claim Ukraine has refuted. The future of the grain program is now in question, so we called up Joseph Glauber. He's a senior research fellow at the International Food Policy Research Institute in Washington, and I asked him how the Black Sea Grain Initiative has been impacting world grain prices.
When the war started, wheat prices in particular skyrocketed. They went up 40% or so, but prices did come down. And really, since the grain initiative started, prices had been pretty flat, essentially pre-war levels. But remember that these levels are 50% higher than they were a year ago.
Where has the grain been going?
Well, it's been going to a variety of places. If you're looking at wheat, 40% of that has been going to countries in the Middle East and North Africa. Some has gone to Europe, in particular corn, so that normally a lot of the corn that Ukraine exports either goes to Europe or China to feed their livestock markets.
What about the distribution of the grain, like in terms of how much is sold commercially and how much of it is going to humanitarian purposes like the World Food Program?
Well, a small part goes to the World Food Program, but that's true year in and year out. There's nothing unique about this year. One of the problems that we've seen over the last 4 weeks, even prior to the suspension, was the fact that a lot of ships were leaving Ukraine. But part of the agreement is that they have to go to Turkey, where they're then inspected and then can proceed on to their destinations. And the wait times in Turkey had started to increase considerably. In fact, they were up to like 16 days. So a lot of grain just hasn't been flowing or has been slowed down even prior to the suspension.
As for these slowdowns, what does this mean further upstream in terms of agricultural production in Ukraine? Do we know how the war has impacted just planting and harvesting this year?
Unfortunately, the agricultural sector has borne a large brunt of the war. There's a lot of grain that was just didn't move like it normally would have moved. So by the time the wheat crop was harvested this year, storage bins were already pretty full. What this suspension of the agreement means is that they're back to this situation where they're only moving 2.5 million tons of grain a month via overland routes. So the grain backs up. And what that means is lower prices for Ukraine farmers. And that creates strong disincentives to plant. And already we see that wheat plantings this fall, which would be harvested next year, are down 30%. The concern is that unless there's something done where a lot of this grain can move and that they can see higher prices, that there will be disincentives to plant. And that essentially prolongs this for 3 years now, for three back-to-back crops being affected by this war.
So food production, of course, globally is very dynamic. Joseph, how does this impact what American farmers can charge for their crops and maybe what they're able to produce?
I think a lot of us expected this year that prior to the war, that given the normal countries respond to high prices by planting more and that prices would start to come down. Unfortunately, that hasn't happened, in part because you have a major supplier like Ukraine pretty much out of the market. It's almost as if Ukraine has had back-to-back droughts for 2 years and now potentially a third year with the disruption. Mm. And that just means that markets will remain tight going into 2023 and likely through 2023 unless we see some relief here.
Joseph Glauber is a senior research fellow at the International Food Policy Research Institute. Joe, thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
Britain's new Prime Minister Rishi Sunak hasn't even been in office for a full week, and he's already facing a political crisis involving one of his most senior ministers. Home Secretary Suella Braverman is embroiled in a scandal over dire conditions for migrants at a UK detention facility. This is the second time Braverman finds herself at the center of a big public controversy. When she was Home Secretary under the previous Prime Minister, she was forced to resign for failing to follow security procedures. Our Europe correspondent, Orla Barry, is on the line to explain all this. Orla, tell us more about Suella Braverman, forced to resign under Liz Truss, but reinstated as Home Secretary by Rishi Sunak last week. That would seem to be a fairly impressive political comeback.
Yeah, that's right. And the Home Secretary job is all about overseeing the UK's borders and policing in Britain. And Braverman herself has been famously hardline in her stance on immigration. She strongly supported the UK's policy to ship migrants off to Rwanda, for example. But as you pointed out, she was forced to resign from Liz Truss's government. The day after she resigned, Liz Truss herself stood down and the whole government collapsed. And then a few days later, Rishi Sunak, as new Prime Minister, appointed Braverman back into her old job. Now, opposition politicians say Sunak must have done that because he made a deal with her that she would get this job if she supported his leadership bid. Sunak says he reappointed her because she brings back experience and stability to the role.
Once again, though, she's facing questions, this time over immigration policy. What's at the heart of this latest controversy?
Yeah, this centres around one migrant processing facility in particular, although it is a bigger issue than just this centre. But this facility, it's known as the Manston Processing Centre. And the idea was that the centre would be a 24-hour holding facility. So migrants would arrive, they would undergo security and identity checks, and then they'd be moved on to more suitable accommodation. And it was reported at the time that it had the capacity for around 1,500 people. Right now, under Suella Braverman's time in office, it's been reported that that number has gone up to around 4,000, that some have been there for weeks. Many have had no access to fresh air, to exercise, or even to a bed. There's been reports of outbreaks of diphtheria and scabies at the site. And then this past weekend, the Times of London newspaper reported that Braverman was told 3 weeks ago about the conditions at the centre and that this was illegal. And the paper alleged that government officials said Braverman was told that migrants needed to be moved to an alternative accommodation, even if that meant moving them to hotels, and that she refused to allow it.
So what did Suella Braverman say in response to these reports?
She said that they're not true. This was Braverman speaking in Parliament yesterday.
To be clear, like the majority of the British people, I am very concerned about hotels, but I've never blocked their usage, and I've never ignored legal advice.
But then she did go on to say that she will refuse to release people from these processing centres if she feels there's no suitable accommodation for them to go to, that she won't just let them go out into the community. Then after that speech, she sort of went on a bit of a rant against immigration, frankly, talking about the invasion of migrants into southern England.
Orlo, where's all this headed? Is it looking like Braverman will be forced to resign once again? And what would that mean for Rishi Sunak's government?
I mean, honestly, it seems pretty unlikely right now because with regard to her position on immigration and that processing centre, she's standing firm. And that position appeals to a lot of Conservative voters. And with regards to the email saga, there are some questions still being asked because it emerged in the last few days that she did this not just on one occasion, sending government documents to personal email, but she did it on 6 separate occasions. But the British public are less concerned about that. That's not really a big issue in the public's mind. And Suella Braverman herself is saying, look, this is just a witch hunt by opposition lawmakers against me. And for now, Rishi Sunak seems to agree with her and he seems to be happy to have her at his side.
The British political boat still a little tippy, though. The World's Orla Barry in London. Mm-hmm. Thanks very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. In Belgium, a national debate is unfolding about euthanasia. This fall, it was revealed that a 23-year-old woman who had survived the 2016 terrorist attack on the Brussels airport ended her life in May because she was suffering from PTSD and depression. Euthanasia is legal under Belgian law. Citizens can also seek doctor-assisted suicide without having a terminal illness. The European Institute of Bioethics opposes the practice. Leopold van Bellingen is a senior researcher with that think tank. A note to listeners, suicide was the focus of our discussion. I asked van Bellingen why the case of Shanti Decourt has drawn so much attention and scrutiny.
Well, the thing is, of course, she was very young. She was a 23-year-old woman. As you mentioned, she was among the victims of the March 2016 terrorist attack at the Brussels airport. The euthanasia was justified because basically of depression, of mental disorder. The problem here is that one of the requirements of the law is that the physician considers together with the patient that there is no other alternative, basically. And in this case, some psychiatrists did consider that there were still treatments available. The physicians could have tried, and that euthanasia was a bit too quick, I would say, in her case.
In your opinion, was suicide really the last option?
Well, in my opinion, in the opinion of the European Institute of Bioethics, we could not consider assisted suicide or euthanasia as a sort of alternative. In this case, what is striking is that Shanti Decourt suffered depression for a long time. At some point, she considered that she really wanted to die, and she actually found physicians who were okay with her request. So that's the problem in Belgium in general with euthanasia. If you want to die, you will find physicians who would agree to do it, and then you will have the requirements of the law that are formally fulfilled.
So let me ask you this. Has assisted suicide become too easy an option in Belgium?
It has been too easy, not only because the law is not properly respected, but also because it is not properly controlled. In this case, the European Court of Human Rights basically says that the control committee is not independent because several members of this control committee do themselves practice euthanasia. So they will control their own euthanasia.
How has suicide been discussed since euthanasia became legal in Belgium some 20 years ago? Is there any stigma today?
When we talk about euthanasia in Belgium, people do not associate it with suicide. We do not talk about assisted suicide. We always talk about euthanasia. Although we see things change, especially with cases such as Shanti's case, this is the weird thing here, I would say, is that one of the symptoms of depression is the willingness to die, and the way some physicians are going to respond to this symptom is with the symptom itself by agreeing that the patient should die. More generally, what we see is contradiction between the public health policies regarding suicide prevention in Belgium and, on the other hand, all the euthanasia legal framework.
Leopold van Bellingen is a research fellow at the European Institute of Bioethics, speaking with us about concerns in Belgium over the use of the country's euthanasia law. Leopold, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
In 2019, Chinese tourists took more than 150 million trips abroad. Then the pandemic hit. China's zero COVID policies and high airline prices have made it difficult for people to leave China or even their hometowns. That has led to a boom in camping, but not the strap on your backpack and be one with nature kind of camping. The World's Rebecca Canther reports from Shanghai.
At a mountaintop campsite on the eastern coast of China, Bian Kezi is busy setting up tents for new visitors. He and his girlfriend have been camping for years, but last month they decided to make their hobby into a side gig. They rented a plot of land just outside the city of Fuyang, and are turning it into a high-end campground. That means fairy lights, a gourmet coffee cart, and catering. The camping trend is exploding right now, he says. People want to enjoy a more comfortable camping experience. Luxury campsites like this one are growing in popularity all over China. Some offer air-conditioned tents, outdoor cinemas, and comfy beds. All the amenities of home, just outdoors. Jackie Luo and his family have brought the ingredients for an elaborate homemade barbecue and hot pot meal under the stars. Luo used to take his family traveling abroad once or twice a year. But with international travel and even out-of-town tourism close to impossible, they've taken up camping near where they live. We brought a lot of food, he says. It's important to eat well, even when we're camping. Other campers appear to agree. As I explore the grounds, I see people enjoying pizza, gourmet desserts, and fancy boba tea. For some people, this is a really new experience. Lily Ni is here with her extended family. There's about 16 of them all together, and she says it will be their first night sleeping in tents. We wanted to travel, but my daughter's school won't even let us leave town without a lot of paperwork and COVID tests, she says. So we decided to try something new nearby. Many people in China have become interested in camping simply because it's become less of a hassle than a traditional hotel vacation. That might sound counterintuitive, but everyone at the campsite seems to know someone who got stuck someplace on holiday because of a COVID outbreak. Marketing analyst Iris Zuo says camping close by just seems like a safer option.
People don't want to spend too much time on COVID testing and transportation. They just want to enjoy the short but happy time.
Zuo says that's what's fueling the growth of the local outdoor tourism industry. Beijing supports this trend. Last year, it announced a 5-year plan to promote outdoor recreation. One priority, building more campgrounds. Local governments also see the benefits of drawing people outside.
They have promoted a lot on what they call the rural revitalization.
Albert Wu is the co-founder of a luxury outdoor travel company.
They have definitely been building roads into villages and trying to rebuild the infrastructure in many of the remote areas, especially like toilet, water, and all that. And that, of course, then promotes what you call rural tourism.
Back at the campsite, Jackie Luo and his family are enjoying music playing on a Bluetooth speaker and staring at the city lights in the distance. Still, he says what he likes about camping is communing with nature. We can reconnect in person, he says. There's no signal, and no one's looking at their phones. But even if he's not scrolling on his phone now, he says he'll definitely be posting pictures of his camping trip later. Camping expert Rahul Liu says this is quite common now. Liu makes his living posting about his camping adventures. It's the most popular thing to post on your feed, he says. No one wants to be left behind. So if you don't post your own camping pic, you're out, he says. Liu believes this trend will fade once COVID travel restrictions have eased. But he's happy that China now has a vibrant camping community. For The World, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
We'll be right back with more in the next half of the show. You're listening to The World. Traffic jams on the highways of Tibet, miles of cars with Chinese migrant workers leaving the region. Last week, they clashed with police and demonstrated on the streets of Lhasa, frustrated by heavy-handed COVID lockdowns. This week, the Chinese migrants got permission to travel home. Officials listen to their grievances. That story coming up this half hour here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The Russian invasion of Ukraine has displaced more than 15 million people, making it one of the worst refugee crises in modern history. The war has also pushed about 1 million Russians to flee their country. In the first 2 weeks after President Vladimir Putin announced a nationwide mobilization of new military recruits, an estimated 200,000 Russians poured across the border into Kazakhstan in Central Asia. It's a popular choice for Russians without passports, but now many are trying to figure out where to go from there. The world's Duri Biskaran reports from the Kazakh city of Almaty.
In a rented house on the outskirts of Almaty, a pot of borscht and a pan of dumplings sizzle on the stove, filling the kitchen with a warm scent. 33-year-old Ivan, who used to manage a sportswear shop in Samara, Russia, takes charge.
I like good food and
I don't trust anyone else with it, he jokes. Like most of his housemates, he's asked to go by only his first name, due to risks his wife and daughter could face back home in Russia if he speaks out against the government publicly. Upstairs, 14 neatly made mattresses are divided among three bedrooms. A window looks out at the snow-encrusted peaks of the Tian Shan Mountains. It's always been my dream to live near the mountains, says Alexei, a former factory worker. This shelter is one of four that were set up across Kazakhstan by the Anti-War Committee of Russia, an organization led by exiled members of Russia's political opposition, as hundreds of thousands of young men streamed into Central Asia to avoid the draft about a month ago. Activists realized that many of the new arrivals were jobless, homeless, and without legal papers. Ilya Molchanov runs this shelter in Almaty. Potential residents sent him applications, and he prioritizes the ones he considers to be the most vulnerable, people who can't afford housing, and people who opposed the government in Russia. In the shelter, chores are shared, meals are taken together. The residents follow the news constantly, because the course of the war in Ukraine, and how other countries respond to it, will also determine when they can see their families again. Western media says that everyone in Russia needs to protest and kick Putin out, Ivan says. But if you go against the government, they just kill you. One activist is a slight blonde who asked to remain completely anonymous due to concerns for his family. He says he was served a draft notice after being arrested at an anti-draft protest in Moscow. He left on a train the next day. Those who have protested will be drafted, he says, and either they'll disappear or they'll be thrown into a war. Several men in the shelter don't have an international passport. They went to Kazakhstan because it's one of just a couple of countries that allows Russian citizens to enter visa-free and with just a Russian national ID for a 90-day stay. Vyacheslav, an activist from Moscow, says it feels safer to be in Kazakhstan, but he's worried he could get deported if he doesn't find another place to go.
Они говорят, оставайтесь в Казахстане, вам поможет Казахстан. Казахстан не может помочь, он был точно не готов к этому.
Kazakhstan wasn't prepared to accept more than 50,000 Russians who plan to stay permanently, he says. You can see it in the cost of rent. It's going up every day. Vyacheslav and other men in the shelter spend their days visiting various consulates and UN offices around Almaty, asking for guidance on what to do. They expected help when they left Russia to avoid the draft, but now they feel abandoned. On a recent morning, a group from the shelter visited the U.S. consulate in Almaty. Half an hour later, they came out with blank forms, shaking their heads.
Каким предлогом сказали, что вся информация находится на этой бумажке, то есть.
They told us we can't meet with anyone, and we have to fill out these paper surveys, says Artem, a photographer from Siberia. That it's the first step to getting a visa.
Но из-за этих данных создаться проблема у тебя, ты точно, ну мы сейчас в принципе все не можем визу получить.
It feels risky, says another. If you share this information with the U.S. government, what will happen with your relatives in Russia, with your wife, your children? I turn back to Ivan, the clothing store manager from a small city.
What's your plan? Are you going to try something else?
We don't have plan. We don't have plan. We don't know what we do later. Thinking.
He has 60 days left to figure it out. For the world, I'm Dari Buscarin in Almaty, Kazakhstan.
Chinese migrant workers in Tibet are leaving the autonomous region and making an exodus back to their homes in China. This comes after those workers protested against strict COVID rules. Videos on social media showed them last week in the streets of the regional capital Lhasa, demonstrating and clashing with police. That is very rare. The Chinese workers were demanding that they be able to go home after 3 months of COVID lockdown in Lhasa. Robbie Barnett is a writer and researcher on modern Tibet at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London. He's been following this closely. Robbie, tell us what you know. When did these protests take place and how many Chinese workers are we talking about who took to the streets?
Well, the protest happened in the afternoon and evening, well into the night of the 26th, so that's Wednesday. And we can see from a number of videos, there are about 6, 7, or 8 videos, little snapshots that people sent out, that there were several hundred people involved. Almost all of them, as you said, Chinese. And very little conflict, actually. It's only towards the end of the protest in the evening that we start to see some scuffles with police. But most of the time, the police are standing around, not really intervening with the Chinese migrants who are demanding that they get permission to go home.
At the end of it all, were any of these Chinese protesters arrested as they demonstrated?
No, it seems not. And in fact, one journalist says that they called up the police in Lhasa and were told that nobody had been arrested. And that matches with the information I'm hearing. It seems to have gone off very calmly, very quietly, apart from very small scuffles.
There's one video which you actually posted on your Twitter feed. In it, we hear a Chinese official talking to the protesters. Let's just hear that for a couple of seconds. Robbie, what is he telling these demonstrators?
Well, I'm better in Tibetan than I am in Chinese, but at one point he's telling them, send us representatives who we can talk to. And then later he says, we're going to get you permission. We'll find a way to do this, something like that. But that is, in fact, what happened. There was a discussion between the demonstrators and the officials, took some time, and the officials came back, and we have other videos showing this, and said, we'll make it possible for you to leave despite the lockdown. And indeed, that's what happened. They were allowed to go home. They were told you can get permission as long as you have negative test results for the past 7 days and can show that, something like that. The next day, we got videos of huge queues of these people queuing outside the offices to get the paper to confirm they had that permission. And the following day, we get videos of huge traffic jams. Even the whole city was in gridlock as these people started to drive home.
I mean, even if these weren't Tibetan protesters, they're Han Chinese. How surprising was this reaction from officials?
Well, what's kind of surprising is not that there was a protest, really. Protests are happening throughout China, much larger protests by Chinese people about COVID conditions and lockdown rules. What's surprising, in a way, is that the Chinese police in Tibet gave in so quickly, that the officials gave in and gave them permission to return very fast, really, by the next morning, and now they're all on the way back. I think this is suggesting to people in South Tibet, certainly, that Chinese are given better treatment than Tibetans. That's how Tibetans are interpreting this. We can see them posting messages privately on WeChat where they refer to this kind of protest as a phrase they use in Chinese, children crying to get candy. They refer to this not really as a protest, but a method of putting pressure on officials to get a benefit. And that's indeed what happened. The suggestion from Tibetans is if this had been Tibetans doing that, they might not have got that leeway. They might not have got that response.
There are also lots of Tibetans being quarantined in Lhasa. What about those numbers?
The big issue about lockdown in Tibet, and I think this is going to become the issue more and more in the rest of China, is not the conditions when you're confined to your home, you can't move for 2 months, difficult to get food and so on. It's the fact that the Lhasa government is strictly following the rules from Beijing, which says we must move all COVID out of society. And the way they do that is they take anybody who's a close contact of a case and put the close contact in what they call a fengsang, a centralized isolation point, what we would call a quarantine camp. And in some of these quarantine camps, we found about 15 or 20 of them. There may be, you know, at least 2,000 people on average. And conditions in those camps where people are made to stay for 2 weeks at least till they get successive negative results, often very bad, quite hard to get food. We see pictures, a film of them in car parks, converted exhibition halls, full stadiums, people living there, hundreds and hundreds of people in one single space for weeks and weeks. This has become very unpleasant for people. And we have seen some reports of people committing suicide in these places, at least in 2 or 3 cases. This is really creating huge stress for people in Tibet, the fear that they might be taken to one of these camps.
Robbie Barnett is a professorial research associate at the University of London School of Oriental and African Studies. Robbie, thanks very much.
And thank you.
In Tokyo today, the municipal government started issuing certificates to same-sex couples, allowing them to be considered married for the purposes of some services related to housing, health, and welfare. Japan still does not recognize same-sex unions as marriages, and the same holds true for most countries across Asia. Taiwan is the only place in the region where same-sex marriage is legal. In the capital, Taipei, this weekend, more than 100,000 people celebrated LGBTQ Pride. It's one of the biggest pride events in Asia. From Taipei, Ashish Valentine reports on Taiwan's role as a leader on LGBTQ issues and the rights people are still fighting for.
It rained the entire day, but that couldn't stop the feeling of sheer joy as thousands packed Taipei's City Hall Plaza to watch performances and speeches and parade through the heart of downtown. It was a celebration and a protest. Groups representing trans people, sex workers, people living with HIV and AIDS, and other marginalized communities called for social and political change. Taiwan legalized same-sex marriage 3 years ago. Sean Du is the Secretary General of a hotline serving LGBTQ people. He says since then, queer identities have become much more normalized.
More and more people are willing to come out and are willing to get married and be blessed by others.
Still, queer couples mostly can't adopt children, get legal recognition if one partner's from a different country, or use assisted reproductive technologies. Trans communities had their own 3,000-person-strong trans march the evening before Pride. Many are pushing the government to make it easier to change their gender on official ID. Jaden Su is a trans and non-binary advocate. Right now, trans people can change their officially registered gender, but Su says it's a long and painful process involving mandatory gender reassignment surgery.
Whether you like it or not, this is a very violent regulation.
Many trans advocates say that not having their real gender reflected on official ID contributes to being misgendered in places like hospitals and schools.
It's a lot of hassle to have to defend your existence just on a Tuesday.
Despite the issues, Su says one reason queer and trans communities have achieved progress here is Taiwan's history of struggle against authoritarian rule.
We came from a 38-year martial law. We knew what it was like to have our safety and freedom violated on a such an extreme level that we really don't want that to ever happen again.
Wen Liu agrees. She's an expert on LGBTQ issues in Taiwan at Academia Sinica. She says that as queer and trans people push for better rights here, many also fear the progress they've already made could be undone if Taiwan falls under Chinese control.
I think for our generation, we really see how the threat of China to undermine Taiwan's democracy in which LGBTQ rights can survive, it's necessary, right, to have any kind of further momentum of LGBTQ activism.
Queer communities from all over Asia and the world were represented here. Activists from Japan and Hong Kong praised Taiwan's progress on marriage equality and human rights. People were particularly inspired by queer Ukrainian activists because of the parallels between Taiwan and Ukraine. Oleg Shin, a Ukrainian who lives in Taiwan, called for Taiwanese people to continue supporting Ukraine's LGBTQ communities.
Queer Ukrainians are helping refugees, collecting humanitarian aid, and supporting the army. And unfortunately, too many have already lost their lives. Please keep supporting Ukraine and Ukraine's LGBTQ plus community.
The crowd yelled their support. Scholar Wen Liu says that for the new generation, attitudes are changing.
This younger generation of folks were mostly pro-LGBTQ rights. So they are like our hope and optimism. They are really challenging the status quo of traditional politics.
On stage, Taipei rock band Pisco represented a new generation that unapologetically supports LGBTQ rights. Their single, Teary Eyes, is about the isolation queer young people feel when their identities aren't understood. For The World, this is Ashish Valentine in Taipei.
快乐是什么？我怎么都不懂，微笑又是什么？嘴角怎么长？
It can be tough to remember everyone's name at a party, but at a recent gathering in Tokyo, that was a no-brainer. All 178 guests had the same name, Hirokazu Tanaka. Local reports say they came from all walks of life and spanned generations. There was a 3-year-old Hirokazu Tanaka and an 80-year-old Hirokazu Tanaka. One Hirokazu Tanaka even flew to Japan from Vietnam for the occasion. You're probably wondering how 178 people with the same name were at the same gathering. Well, that was the point. The event broke the Guinness World Record for the largest convening of people with the same name, a record previously held by 164 people, all named Martha Stewart. Organizers say they hope to set a high bar for silliness. Rising numbers of people are crossing into Canada from the U.S. through unofficial entry points. More than 27,000 migrants have left the United States on foot so far this year, hoping for asylum in Canada. That is 30% more than all of 2017, when the Canadian government started tracking these numbers. Canada's Supreme Court is now weighing whether to change the legal pathway for asylum seekers. The World's Bianca Hillier visited the U.S.-Canadian border to find out more.
Part of the reason so many migrants are crossing from the U.S. into Canada right now is because pandemic restrictions have eased. Janet Dench is the executive director of the Canadian Council for Refugees. She says now that the border is back open,
it's kind of to be expected that there would be a backlog of people that were wanting to come up and attempt to enter Canada.
Dench says there was also a rise in crossings during the Trump administration.
People who had been in the U.S. for a long time, and other people who were more recently arrived felt very much that U.S. was not going to be a safe space for them. And so that led to a big increase.
The idea that the U.S. isn't a safe space for refugees is actually something Dench and other advocates have been arguing long before Trump took office. In particular, many have criticized what's called the Safe Third Country Agreement, or the STCA.
Its purpose is to share refugee responsibilities between the two countries.
Maureen Silkoff is an immigration and refugee lawyer in Toronto. She says the STCA is based on the idea that both the U.S. and Canada are safe and offer the same fair access to refugee status. In place since 2004, the agreement forces asylum seekers to make claims for protection where they first arrive, either the U.S. or Canada, which means
if somebody is in the United States and they would like to cross the border into Canada to seek refugee protection, they're essentially turned back into the United States.
But there's a loophole. If asylum seekers are able to make it into Canada, then they can seek protection there. So many opt to avoid official ports of entry and instead seek out unofficial paths, which can be dicey.
It's actually a testament to the degree to which they fear harm if they go back to their country of origin that they take to crossing between ports of entry. And one of the more well-known areas has been Roxham Road.
Roxham Road is in rural upstate New York. There's no street sign or real marker, but there is a dead-end sign right at the start of the road. That sign doesn't tell the full story, though. If you turn onto Roxham Road and drive north, you'll pass more livestock than mailboxes. And after a couple of minutes, you'll run right into the Canadian border. You'll be greeted by members of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, waiting to intercept people who are trying to cross from the U.S. into Canada at this unofficial entry point. When I visit Roxham Road, I see dozens of people making this journey. Some are alone, but most are with family members. A young girl seems to find comfort in her stuffed animal, which talks back to her. Taxi drivers, who make this trip multiple times a day, quickly unload backpacks and suitcases from the trunk before taking off down the road. Once people have their belongings, Canadian police motion them over to the border. When a van full of people from Haiti arrives, authorities ask them to stand with only their direct family members. Then the police start their spiel. Throughout the day, I hear it in French, Arabic, and English, to name a few.
Okay, I will explain to you in English. If you cross here, you will be arrested. It's illegal to cross here. You understand that?
A man says yes, softly.
If you want to cross at the border, it's at 5 kilometers that way. You understand?
He says yes again and starts wheeling his suitcase across the invisible border.
Okay. Now you're under arrest for the illegal entry in Canada. You understand?
Asylum seekers are given a face mask and then led into a tent to be assessed for processing. Police screen them for any involvement in illegal activity. If they pass, they're then sent to the Canada Border Services Agency to have their asylum claim processed. Most people who have illegally crossed into Canada this year have done so on Roxham Road. Patty Obriat lives there and says the flow of migrants is nearly constant.
It's a lot. We have maybe 4 or 5 vans, sometimes at a time, going down there.
Obriat and other Roxham Road residents I spoke with say, aside from a few taxis speeding down the road, they don't mind living on what has become such a popular throughway.
They don't bother my yard or anything. They just walk on by or drive by.
The Roxham Road traffic could lighten, depending on how Canada's Supreme Court rules. They're currently weighing if the STCA is constitutional, and if Canada can trust the U.S. as a safe place for refugees. If the answer is no, the agreement could be overturned. Janet Dench says that would allow people to safely cross all along the border at official entry points.
Instead of all arriving at Roxham Road, people could arrive and make their claims at any port of entry right across the country, and it would be much more evenly distributed and therefore easier to manage.
A U.S. State Department spokesperson declined to comment on the claims that the U.S. is not a safe place for refugees. In an email, Canada's Federal Immigration Department said both countries have asylum systems that meet international standards. The department added that modernizing the agreement has been a government priority for several years, but declined to detail what those updates could look like. Canada's Supreme Court is expected to return their decision on the STCA within months. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier in Quebec.
On the heels of Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva's victory in the Brazilian presidential election, we leave you today with new music from Brazil via Los Angeles. This comes courtesy of a musician from Rio de Janeiro, Roger. Full name, Jose Cury. Once the nightclubs of Rio got to know his blend of samba and funk, a single name was all he needed. But fame in Rio and 8 recordings still were not enough to get him wider exposure in his country, even after having co-written the theme song for the 2016 Rio Olympics. So he upped sticks and headed to L.A. This track, Existe Uma Voz, Portuguese for There's a Voice, is a product of his new California home and carries a message we can all endorse. Don't be swayed by peer pressure. Follow your inner voice.
Vem pra cá, um de nós. Existe uma voz que mostra o caminho certo pra quem tá esperto. Que mostra o caminho certo pra ficar esperto. Às vezes no meio da jogada tem uma encruzilhada de cara pra gente saber.
New music there from Brazilian singer Roger. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. We'll see you right back here tomorrow. Marco here, and before we go, I want to remind you that The World is fundraising from now through December 31st. Our goal is to reach 1,000 donors before the end of the year. Your donation will help power our nonprofit newsroom so we can continue to bring you the best in international reporting. You can visit theworld.org/give to learn more and donate. Thank you so much, and be well.
From PRX.